resistor big enough you can put on there that's not going to create a significant loading, because just the stray capacitance of the resistor becomes a significant load to the circuit. So a pure capacitor divider network, which may consist of nothing more than a 1 centimeter square of metal connected to a probe, and that square of metal and probe is held, let me pick a number, 1 foot away. What would that be? 25 centimeters away, so to speak, from the device you want to measure. And then knowing that the divider network of the stray capacitance between your 1 square centimeter...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can easily quantify the amount of stray capacitance between your device to be measured and your 1 square centimeter probe 1 foot away of my example. And you can also quantify the amount of capacitance between your probe and its internal ground, and therefore you know the voltage divider ratio, and it might be, let me pick a number, 1,000 to 1. That means every volt that you see on the screen of the oscilloscope represents 1,000 volts at the peak of your Tesla coil. So that's one of the ways I would attack the problem, Wesley. But before we send it back to you, let's see what Joe wants to ask about all this. W-H-U-I, I haven't heard you in a while, Joe. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Well, you've been talking about atmospheres go from 1 atmosphere to less than 1 atmosphere, and talking about the breakdown. What happens when you start going into positive atmospheres, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 atmospheres? What happens to the breakdown of the then?
Hey, Joseph, there is a scientist. That's an extremely logical question. And when you Google the word passion curve, and you look at that curve, you'll see that from, let me pick a number, I'm looking at the curve right now, from roughly 80,000 feet all the way down to sea level, the curve is extremely linear. If you went to 2 atmospheres instead of 1 atmosphere, the voltage breakdown would be approximately double. Every time you double the atmospheric pressure, the voltage breakdown increases. The air itself is breaking down. If you pack the air molecules closer together because they're at a higher pressure, common sense tells you they gotta break down sooner. They do not. They break down later. Ain't that interesting? And I think I can explain it. Just for the hell of it, Joe, if you had to make a guess as to why that takes place, what do you think is going on there? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
I don't know. I'm asking you because I thought you're the professor on this type of subject, that you've done some work in there. I was just kind of curious. They say 2 atmospheres, the dielectric voltage increases like 2 times. So what is it? Does that mean? Does that say linear? If you go to, say, 4 atmospheres, it's double again. 8 is double of that again.
The electrons don't move as fast as you increase the pressure.
Good guess, Howie. Very good guess, not right. You've used good common sense. That ain't it. But yes, it's a direct proportion as you go above 1 atmosphere, almost a direct proportion. It looks to me like it's a 45-degree line on the curve I'm looking at. Every time you, if I multiplied the air pressure by 10, the dielectric strength of the air would be approximately 10 times higher. Instead of 30,000 volts per centimeter, it would be 300,000 volts per centimeter. Curious phenomena. Real curious. The way air breaks down is a very interesting phenomena in my mind. The way a lightning bolt takes place from a cloud to ground, and why every single lightning bolt is a zigzag. I'm amazed that no one has asked that question up till now. When I do a spark discharge on my Wimhurst machine, every single one of those spark discharges is a very zigzag curve. And if I do the experiment enough times, occasionally the zigzag is so extreme, it almost loops back on itself and then goes forward again. Not quite, but I've seen it come close. And when you look at that in the dark and try to figure out what's going on, strange stuff. Yes, high voltage is a... We amateurs, let me drop...
Yes, it's everything to do with humidity. As you go higher in pressure, less humidity.
Another extremely good guess, Howie. Absolutely wrong. You've used good common sense again. the breakdown of air and the humidity in the air is almost completely unrelated. Crazy stuff. I can take completely dry air and completely wet air and measure, you know, completely saturated air, 98% humidity, so to speak, and the breakdown voltage is the same. Of course, that's common. That's opposite of your experience. A dry winter day, you got your feet across the floor, and you touch a doorknob, and you see a spark. You do that on a hot, humid day in the summertime, and there's absolutely no spark. From that, everyone believes that air breakdown is extremely different with reference to humidity. Good common sense, dead wrong. What's happening on that humid day is that the water that's in the rug, that's on your body, that's on everything that's on the materials that you're bringing together, that's giving you the, why can't I think of the name of it now? the name of it, the effect when you bring various materials together and they develop a high voltage between the two. Anyhow, that the water on the materials creates a resistive path that discharges the materials, so that on a dry day, the discharge doesn't take place and the high voltage gets a chance to build up. But if you run an experiment by putting probes close to each other and increasing the voltage until they break down, and you do it in a vacuum, you do it inside of a bell jar where you have dry air at normal room temperature pressure, and then you do it with moist air, you'll get the exact same breakdown voltage, plus or minus 1 or 2%. Very little difference. So that's not it. Again, good common sense. I'm very disappointed that all the books on the subject don't explain it. There's a lot more going on. I'm not going to give you the whole answer on this one right now, because I'll confuse you if you don't get a chance to hear the whole story. Wesley,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oxygen, if it's pure.
Howie, you were saying something about oxygen. Whether the air is high in oxygen or high in nitrogen, you'll get an extremely similar phenomenon with pressure versus temperature. The pressure curve almost doesn't care which one of the constituents of air you're using. If you're with helium versus argon, whatever, you will see some differences, but not huge differences. The phenomena, that passion curve, you'll get a similar curve for passion on each one of those air molecules you can use. So, why does air break down? Why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? We're going to get into these subjects. Wesley, I know you haven't gotten any of the real answers you're looking for, but my strongest recommendation is that you concentrate on your oscilloscope. It is the lowest inertia machine that can follow the very fast phenomena that you're looking for. Almost all other instrumentation that is not very specifically designed for measuring transient high voltage discharge phenomena, almost all other instrumentation is going to lie to you. A properly used oscilloscope is going to get you there the quickest. That's my suggestion. But I haven't exactly been where you are. I'm not positive. So use this information with caution, Wesley. You're into one hell of a science experiment, and it's going to take you a while, I can see. And it's going to be fascinating to listen to your results. I'm going to turn back to you, Wesley, for a couple more final comments. Then I'm going to have to go over to Mel, because we're passing 9 o'clock. N2XJN, keep up the good work. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Before we fix it up, Dick, I want to make a comment on the Tesla coil, its step function.
Go ahead, make a brief comment about a Tesla coil, Howie.
Okay, when you say he's not doing, when he puts DC voltage into this, and you get a volt on the output, you get some ringing effect. You look at the homogeneous crescent and find out where the poles are, and you got to look at it with a step function. You got to see how the circuit acts. Remember, you have capacitance in between the windings, so you have to look at it. Not in a steady state. You got to look at it in a dynamic state. Look at it transient and do a homogeneous characteristic equations. Go ahead, Dick.
You're on to something on this one, Howie. A Tesla coil, as a schematic diagram on a page, looks like a ordinary transformer as a schematic, not a physical schematic, an electronic schematic. It's got a primary winding and a secondary winding. And you think that if the turns ratio of primary to secondary is 1,000 to 1, you think it's got 1,000 to 1 voltage buildup. That's approximately true. And you think you're putting a discharge of DC voltage into the primary. However, You may not recognize it, but that secondary circuit, it looks like it's a pure winding with a probe on the top of it, which usually is a donut-shaped metallic object or a spherical object. It looks like a inductor. It is a hell of a lot more than that. It is a tuned circuit. It is a resonator. It's got distributed inductance and distributed capacitance. It has a favorite resonant frequency. And if your particular Tesla coil, wound in your particular manner, happens to resonate at 1.5 megacycles, and you put DC current, a pulse of DC current into that primary, and then discontinue that DC current, the secondary will give you an inductive kickback that begins a ringing process that starts at 150 megacycles and rings down, but there's a hell of a lot of other frequency components there, and his spectrum analyzer has already given it some hint to that. So it is, that secondary is a ringing resonant circuit that has a certain coupling coefficient to the primary from which it gets its energy, but there's a lot more going on there than first meets the eye. And it's going to take a while for all the smoke to settle, if you know what I mean, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN. For your comments, I believe that all of the hunt for the free energy came from one factor, and I mentioned it on this TechNet once, which was that it was observed that when the 10 young women tried to push the small car after the while, there is a need only for one woman to push the car, and then after the while, there is a need for one finger of one lady just to sustain the motion. So when you develop certain amount of motion, then you just need to just a little of the energy just to sustain the motion. What Tesla discovered, and this is what is believed, I'm not saying it's true, but it's believed, is that spark has the power of, let's say, 10,000 of the fingers of that lady. The last thing that really I would like to get the answer, you know, you can do it later, or you can do it now, is two magnets of 10 pounds each repelling each other, whether this is a potential energy or this is the kinetic energy. The magnets are in vertical. After 10 years to come over, and then you see that these magnets are still apart. So, back to you, Dick. Thank you very much, everybody, for input in this area. And to share.
I don't think I've got an exact answer to your... I know I don't have an exact answer to your question, Wesley, but I think I've got a partial answer. In classic physics that I think I've been exposed to, kinetic energy is usually defined as energy that exists within an object because of two factors. The object has mass, and the object has speed or velocity. To be more general, I should call it speed. To be exacting with direction, you would call it velocity. Velocity is a speed and a direction. It's a vector. But kinetic energy classically requires mass and speed. If I've got two 10-pound neodymium iron magnets where the north poles are aimed toward each other and they're being held on some kind of a shaft so that their alignment is being defined, but the magnetic field is creating the repulsion by which one of the magnets is sitting on the table and the other one sitting a couple of inches above it. The force created by the two north poles aimed at each other is a little bit like a compressed spring. Compressed spring does have potential energy. The fact that one of those magnets is a couple of inches above the other, and that magnet has got 10 pounds of mass, it has potential energy. But when they're sitting there for 10 years and there is no motion, by the usual definition of physics that I've been exposed to, the kinetic energy is zero. Now, I know that a better scientist than me can now get down to the molecular level and tell you what's going on. Tell you what's going on with the magnetic field. There's two magnetic fields that are opposing each other, and lines of force are present. the usual way we express it. And at the molecular level, there are probably flowing motion of some kind that's creating those lines of force. I'm not convinced that a complete understanding of magnetism exists. And that's part of the reason why these rotary magnetic machines that appear to be creating excess energy are being investigated. Magnetism is only partially understood. Gravity is even less understood. Electrostatic repulsion of equal or electrostatic attraction of unequal charges is only partially understood.
The thing is that this magnet that works, every day you can observe that they change the space for 1 millimeter, let's say, whatever, it depends from, so that is not a kinetic, the potential energy, it's a kinetic energy. And if it could be measured in watts, joules, newtons, whichever, why this energy never dies? Back to you.
Well, let me first see if I understand what you're saying. If I've got these two 10-pound high magnetic field neodymium magnets, and they're on a vertical shaft, a wooden shaft, we'll say, and there's a hole in each of the magnets, and the two north poles are aimed at each other, and so the upper one is being suspended 5 centimeters away. As long as I don't heat or cool those magnets, as long as I don't do anything to disturb them, if I come back 10 years later, won't the upper magnet still be 5 centimeters away, or are you saying that they slowly settle together? How about you, Wesley?
It slowly comes together. So this energy is being used. That's why I simply disagree with the fact that this is no kinetic energy in here. When you try to push something sooner, you got tired. You have no power. When the spring is being compressed, with the time, it loses its power. Now, you cannot say this is a potential energy. It's a kinetic energy that is working. And because of the properties of the air, of the Earth, and because of the Earth being around the Sun and the Moon being around the Earth, you can measure that the distance between two neodymium magnets changes every day, every 24 hours. Now, if that is not kinetic energy, that I do not understand the physics at all. Back to you, Andrew Jim.
Okay, let me give me a little bit more understanding. If those two magnets started off 5 centimeters away today, and I take a measurement every single day, and 10 years from now, they're going to be a little bit closer together. If I plotted that as a graph, would I be predicting that 100 years they would come together?
Depends from the power of the magnets.
I'm going to make a guess that everything above absolute zero has thermal agitation energy of its molecules. The average kinetic energy of the individual molecules are what your thermometer is measuring. If you had a microscope in theory that's high enough in power, and you're looking at the molecules of some solid material, you would see that all those molecules are locked in position, but they're locked in position by very strong springs. They're all weak with reference to each other. That's what temperature is. Because of the thermal energy within those magnets, I am guessing that thermal energy is slowly dissipating the magnetic field, which was created by alignment of the individual little bitty dipoles within each molecule of that magnet. Alignment of those molecules are what give you the strong magnetic field.
Let me interrupt you. Spring is not a good example. It's a mechanical device with vectors in it. Magnetic field depends from magnetism of the Earth and surrounding forces of the magnetic and crossing and changing of the vectors of this field make this kinetic energy work. That's why people believe and they actually build devices they claim to be perpetual motion with over unity. My understanding is that over unity is only within the life of the ant. If the ant lives 3 days, everything that is longer than the life of the ant is over unity and perpetual motion. So I don't care if it's over 100 years and this light bulb is going to be lighting, that's okay with me. Back to you.
Okay, let me try one other experiment on you, Wesley, and see if you and I can agree on this one. When I've got two magnets, one above the other, gravity is trying to bring them together, but the magnetic field being creating the repulsion that's keeping them apart. If I then take those two magnets and suspend them on a wooden rod horizontally, and I push them together with two springs that are connected to some kind of a great big holding fixture, and I measure the force on the springs, I measure the distance between the two magnets, and I calculate the magnetic field I have today. I then take that whole apparatus and put it into orbit on the space shuttle. Now it's highly above the Earth. It's at a greater distance from the center of the Earth. Therefore, the Earth's magnetic field is smaller. But until I wait the 10 years until the magnetic field decreases, when I bring it into space away from the Earth's magnetic field, the same horizontal experiment of two springs and two magnets, won't I measure approximately the same magnetic force? The magnetic force, I think, is a result of the two magnets themselves. They don't necessarily depend on the magnetic field of the Earth and the Moon and everything else around them.
Wrong assumption. These magnets strictly belong to the magnetic field of the Earth. The weight and their power and the repelling factors belong from the other sources of the magnetism, which is the magnetic field of the Earth. But if you put them in space, that would be quite a different story. Back to you.
Okay. If to hold those two magnets 1 centimeter apart requires 1 newton of force, putting them together, and I now bring that apparatus, and they're horizontally displaced so that gravity is not a factor here, I now bring that apparatus far into space. Does the 1 newton of force change? Does the 1 centimeter of distance change? If I bring them away from the Earth into space, does it change, and in what direction does it change? Over to you.
It will change. If we have two magnets in vertical position, the weight of the magnet, the upper magnet, top magnet, all on that, is actually how much the magnetism of the Earth is actually pulling that magnet towards the Earth. So if that is a 10-pound magnet, it is only in that particular position of the Earth, and it's actually only in comparison to what is the mass of this magnet, what is the self-magnetism of that magnet, and repelling factor, if there is any, towards the Earth by itself. Now the lower one, let me jump, and the lower one has the same weight, and the weight comes from the factor that the Earth is actually pulling that magnet. So if we take these two magnets with this space of 1 centimeter to the space, we might see quite different, quite strange reaction, but definitely it would not be a 1 centimeter. Back to you, and to the ship.
Okay, let me go one step further with this experiment. One magnet is on the table, the other magnet weighs 10 pounds, and it suspends itself on a vertical rod, 1 centimeter spacing between the two magnets, when they're vertical. The upper magnet is being pulled down toward the Earth by gravity by a magnitude of 10 pounds because it has 10 pounds of weight, 10 pounds of mass. If I now make a horizontal experiment in which I force the two magnets to be 1 centimeter apart and I force them together with a spring where the spring is applying a force of 10 pounds, would I again see a separation of 1 centimeter. Over to you, Wesley.
Yes, you will. And the reason for that is that you have two springs actually pushing two magnets together in horizontal pattern. And these springs are actually, they're made this way, there is a one centimeter, whatever, space between them. Let me jump. At that point, actually, the mass of each particle magnet will actually be exactly the same. The only thing is that the vector of magnetism of the Earth will still be vertical. So the Earth will pull this magnet also vertical. So this magnet actually will have the same weight. The only thing is that the vector between these two magnets will be horizontal. So, yes, you will have the 1 centimeter, but I do not understand what you're trying to prove by that. But
okay, these two magnets are on a very slippery nylon rod or a Teflon rod, so there's very little friction. The gravity on the two magnets are 10 pounds each, is pulling vertical, but they're on a horizontal rod. They're being held 1 centimeter apart by way of springs applying a force of 10 pounds. You and I are under agreement on that. If I now take that apparatus into outer space, far away from the Earth, and the two 10-pound magnets, 10 pounds of mass, not weight, are still being pushed together with that same spring applying 10 pounds of force, it is my belief that those two magnets will still be 1 centimeter apart, plus or minus a very little difference, because the Earth's magnetic field is very weak compared to the magnetic field of these neodymium magnets. Except for a very small error factor, I think those two magnets in outer space, held together with a 10-pound spring, are still going to be 1 centimeter apart. I wonder if you agree with that. N2XJN, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Disagree with that. When you observe the spaceship actually going to the space, it doesn't go on the straight line, it goes on the spiral line. So that means that the vectors of force on the trajectory of that spaceship is different, and is different just because of few factors. The first, rotation of the Earth, and the second factor is actually the characteristic of the magnetic field. If you look at the Milky Way, you see that the Milky Way has a spiral pattern. And the same story I was picturing when I was talking about Rodin coil, which actually is a bipolar coil with a certain angle, and Marco Rodin mathematics. So, that's my answer, if I was clear in this area.
You know that funny things will happen by the way I do a spiral acceleration to get out into space. But now I push myself out into space a long distance away from the Earth, one of the outer Lagrange points, and I now stop moving, or I'm moving very slowly. I'm still following the Earth's orbit once around the Sun every 365 days, but I'm far away from the Earth. I'm now really in free space, and I'm not being accelerated. And I'm still pushing those two magnets together with 10 pounds of force. Except for a very small error factor, I think those two magnets will be very close to 1 centimeter apart.
They will not, and the answer for this is like that.
Will they be more or less than 1 centimeter apart?
Will be more than 1 centimeter apart at a certain condition, and less at a certain condition. If they're in free space, when the magnetic field of the surroundings is very weak, then we know that the typical weight of the spring by itself in the Earth is different than the same weight of this particular spring in the space. The same story, the power of the vectors of the spring behaves different way in the space than in the Earth. So at that point, the distance will always change. Am I right or wrong?
Everything can make a change, but now let's give it magnitudes. If on the horizontal experiment on the surface of the Earth, they're held together 1 centimeter because of the magnetic field and the 10 pounds of force from the spring, and now I'm truly in free space, not being accelerated, I think they're going to be close to 1 centimeter apart. You say it's going to be different.
If you say ionic accelerator, that means the particles that could push the rocket to a certain speed. Particles. So we're talking about very small structures that could create a speed and increase of the speed. Then we're talking about the spring by itself with a certain force at the surface of the Earth, and then at the surface of free space. We're talking about quite different behavior of the factors. Back to you.
I think they're going to be very close to 1 centimeter apart, and you say it's going to be different. I'm asking you how different. Are they going to be 0.5 centimeter or 1.5 centimeters? I think it's going to be 1 centimeter plus or minus a small amount. What's your belief on this one, Wesley?
My understanding is it's going to be 1 centimeter plus, but if we're talking about less magnetic field, then in the Earth is going to be, very nice experiment that was made by a Russian scientist, I don't recall the name, in the South Pole. And what he actually find out is that the spring is longer, not shorter, longer than the Earth ring. I forgot how to say it in English. Back to you.
Okay, I've got to go over to Mel, but one last question, Wesley. I'm trying to pin down a magnitude. I know I've hit you with an unfair question because you don't have enough time to do the calculation, but I'm asking for a gut feel. Instead of 1 centimeter apart when they're far away from the Earth in free space, do you think the 1 centimeter is going to become 1.5 centimeters? Over to you, Wesley.
God, I don't know how to answer this question. I do not know. Simply, I do not know. I believe it might be 2 centimeters. Because because spring represent vectors, and there is no push-pull. In other words is that when you're trying to swim in the water, you're actually pushing the vector towards you. But then you have the, you're trying to be in the water against the river of that water of that river. Now, these vectors are canceling somehow, depends from the speed of the water. In the free space, you have less factors that are in minus or opposite than you have in the Earth. So my understanding is that the spring has a free movement. At the same time, the vectors that are actually on this particular springs are less. So at this point, the distance may only increase. Back to you.
Okay, we're going to have more discussions on this in later on, probably in future weeks. But you felt it's going to be significantly greater than 1 centimeter, maybe as much as 2 centimeters, and we'll be discussing that. And we'll eventually get to the bottom of this, although it's going to take a while. Hang in there. Mel, what would you like to talk about tonight? I know you've been getting lots of mail on vertical antennas, and the latest issue of QST Magazine, as I said, on page 55, has quite a bit of material that will help a little bit. K2KEY, K2LIW on the chat.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I'll just say a final word about that oscilloscope you mentioned, about oscilloscope that was for electrostatic measurements or whatever. I know it was a scope that I had. I picked it up at a bunch of lab equipment. I believe it was Tektronix number 200-something, 205-79, and it came with a special probe called the million megohm probe. And I know I dumped the scope a couple of years ago at a ham fest. And the probe, I don't know what happened to the probe. I know I didn't get rid of the probe at the time, but it was marked on a probe one times 10 to the 12th input. So I don't know where it is, but that was something that Tektronix had. You may be able to find them if you look online. Okay, let's talk about what I've been getting. I've got at least 50 emails about these verticals, that they like to know which one to invest in, because as you can see by what we've talked about in the last few weeks, the price-wise, these verticals vary. Let me let it drop. From a number of hundreds of dollars up to about $900. So, to answer the question, I basically said, well, I'm going to bring it up on the TechNet. Something like, as the saying goes, what is old can be new again. 25, 30 years ago, Jerry Civic tackled a similar problem, and I'll tell you how he went about it and how you can go about doing the same experiment. This will give you a ballpark idea of how this antenna will behave. One of these antennas will behave before you plunk down the dollar bill that you may not be so happy, and for a very fraction of the cost, I'll tell you exactly how Jerry Civic did it, and I'm sure most everybody will be able to duplicate this situation. As we mentioned, Vic, you said somebody that Ham should be able to more or less duplicate that one of these antennas for a fraction of the cost. Well, Jerry Civic actually laid out the entire experiment and how he did it, Dick, over.
Yeah, tell me once again, Jerry Civic's call letters, Mel.
Hey, Jerry Civic, who I had the good fortune to visit a couple of times, pleasure to meet him many years ago. His call was W2FMI, Frank Mary India, FMI. And he's a silent key now. He was an engineer, a scientist, a ham radio operator that liked to take the theory, wrote a lot of theory, a lot of articles, but he also did the practical, showed you how to make them work. So this was one of his theories. I dug it out, and it's interesting because basically this is what we discussed, Dick, over.
Yeah, you can buy from, who is it now? I think it's from ARRL, a series of tapes that were recorded by Jerry FMI with reference to balans, ferrite balans in particular. I bought some of those, very, very well done. He had a whole series of articles in QST magazine, and he was quite often on the front cover. Particularly, I remember one particular issue of QST where his wife is sitting under an umbrella-like device in a long lawn chair in the middle of his front lawn. And that was a miniaturized antenna. And what, as I remember, Jerry basically proved, let me drop, is that if you have enough ground plane radials laid down, you can electronically shrink the radiator section of a vertical antenna, significant percentages, and with the right kind of impedance matching devices, particularly ferrite transformers, you can come back to nearly full performance. As I remember, he was getting extremely good performance with short vertical antennas, if and only if you had a whole lot of ground plane radials down. Now, is that the economic way of doing it? By the time you lay down all those radials, and what you're trying to do is create a mirror image of the other half of the radiator. And I think it's easier to create the other half of the radiator by really creating the other half. A pure vertical half-wave dipole is a hell of a lot simpler. And to some degree, that subject is covered in the July issue, page 55 of QST Magazine. He talks about an elevated ground plane quarter-wave radiator and a full half-wave vertical radiator. And he compares the results between the two. So, now, would a person, let me drop, would a person get the biggest bang for the dollar, so to speak, or for the amount of material or the amount of wind loading, by setting up a half-wave dipole horizontally polarized in the air? It takes a little bit more real estate. It takes a little more altitude of support structure to do that, as opposed to something that's near ground level that is a vertically polarized quarter-wave radiator, but it requires a lot of radial ground plane radials in order to get high efficiency. I've got some opinions on that, and you can probably tell where I would go. You've done some more experiments on ground plane radiators, vertical radiators, and you've probably got some opinions. I'd like to hear your opinions on this one, Mel. But when it comes to these $400 and $900 things with all the fancy springs and coils and whatever on them and shiny pieces of aluminum, for a person who is economically well off, write a check, buy the piece of equipment, install it, and the problem goes away. But an awful lot of the guys you and I talk to, Mel, don't have deep pockets, and if they're buying $50 worth of hardware but paying $450 for it, that bothers me a little bit. There may be a better approach. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Exactly. The problem is, people have been asking me, how do you go about making one of these things that we were talking about, like you say, that has a few bucks worth of really of hardware and yet has a sufficiently good price tag on that many of them, you will spend your week's income easily on one of these pieces of pipe. Now, Jerry Civic, more or less, did an experiment. Actually, his experiment was that he looked at 40 meters. His interest was for 40 meters because he said that's a great band. It's open fairly most of the time. And the situation is that he says initially he did an experiment with dipoles, 40-meter dipoles, and he came to the conclusion that any of the 7 megahertz dipoles that he put up, that it just did not perform the way he'd like it for, especially DXing, and if they were less than approximately 40 feet up in the air. And he says, yes, he says, they do work, but they don't, you know, a lot of them times, he says, didn't hear the DX stations, or they didn't hear me, or they came in weak, let me let it drop. There's other people that had the sufficient resources to put up either a high dipole or a vertical, you know, were able to do a lot better. The next thing he said was, he says, it would be very nice to have 60-plus feet of pipe standing in the backyard with a great deal of radials laying down. And he says, give me that good low takeoff angle on 7 megahertz. And he says that would be the ideal, you know, answer to the situation. However, he says, this was not, of course, a viable answer because I did visit a Jerry Aaron in New Jersey, not far from where my daughter lives. And he had an average house, average back, nice little backyard, house, one family house with about a 25-foot roof. So he decides to, let's see, he says, I decided he's going to do an experiment. And this is the experiment that he did, and I think the people listening are interested in these antennas. Do this experiment and come to their own conclusion, Dick. I'll describe the experiment that Jerry did right now, unless you have some other comments. Over.
Yeah, Jerry, I think, worked for Bell Laboratories, a real scientist type, and a guy who likes digging into a problem. And when it comes to horizontal dipoles, the classic information is that they work extremely well if you were able to mount them approximately a half wavelength above the ground or greater. 40 feet at 20 meters, for instance, is beautiful. But you'd like to be closer to 80 feet above the ground on a 40-meter dipole. And so that's not within the capability of an awful lot of guys unless you've got some pretty tall trees. Not very many of us amateurs have 80 feet of tower to act as the center support for a horizontal dipole. And if you don't have enough altitude of a horizontal dipole, you end up with a NIVIS antenna, near vertical incident sky wave. The signal essentially goes straight up. To get low angle of radiation out to the horizon requires at least half wavelength of altitude on a horizontal dipole, whereas on a vertical antenna, that low angle of radiation comes a lot easier. You don't need that much altitude, but now you pick up the other problem of ground loss if you don't have a whole lot of ground radials. So it's a kind of a trade-off, is my first impression of this, Mel. You may have some different attitudes, and if so, let's hear about them. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech band.
No, you put it very well, Dick. It's a problem, especially at 7 megahertz, very popular band, so... Jerry said, well, he'd like to try an experiment. I've seen a number of these pipes that they sell, shortened pipes, and how he can make one, see how it would perform. So being, I could say, the scientist, the engineer, the ham, all rolled into one. Here's his experiment. I'm going to lay out the experiment right now. And so this is what many of us can duplicate if this is what you would like to try. He had around, Jerry, at the time, he says, he looked around, he had around his property laying. He had a 10-foot piece of television mast, TV antenna mast, and he also had an 8-foot, he says, whip, a mobile stainless steel whip. And he joined the two of them together, and he wound up with 18-foot of a radiator, basically. He went up on his roof, which is a pitched roof, about 25 feet up. He made up a metal plate, and put a piece of plastic over it. And he took this piece of 18-foot of pipe. Let me let it drop. Because this 18-foot piece of pipe is tied it off at four places with non-metallic guide, basically piece of rope. And he has some telephone wire, as he said, laying around, some surplus from a telephone wire, a number 22 gauge. He laid that out in the roof. They were all various lengths and all. So he said he laid out about 20 pieces of different lengths. And so this was really a bare bone installation. In other words, a piece of pipe standing up there, insulated, standing on this piece of plastic on top of a plate, metal plate. These radios, if you want to call them, just more or less spread around haphazardly, tied them down wherever he could, whatever, how he could, to the edge of the roof, to the gutters, you know, to the nails, he said, that hold the gutters in place. He just wrapped it around them. And this was his installation, and this is what he did from this point on. First of all, can you follow everybody what we are up to right at this point? Over.
I think they are following pretty well, Mel. You've got a pretty good description of limited resources that was available to him, and how can he get the best use of those resources. So without buying a whole lot of expensive materials, he's now making a vertical ground plane antenna and wants to get the greatest amount of performance out of it without elevating it real high in the air. And one of the things I should have mentioned earlier, the magic of vertical polarization is that ground reflection on a vertically polarized signal does not reverse in phase. That's the mechanism by which a low-altitude vertical antenna can give you low angle of radiation. By comparison, a horizontally polarized signal, when it reflects off the ground, must reverse in phase. Therefore, if your horizontal dipole is close to the ground, the real signal coming out of the dipole and the reflected signal coming off the ground are out of phase with each other. That gives you a cancellation on the horizon, and you get some very high angle of radiation, unless you've got at least a half wavelength of spacing. That's what causes that compromise of lots of altitude is required on a horizontal dipole to get low angle of radiation, and not necessarily on a vertical ground plane antenna. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Good question, Dick, on the measurements.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
When you talk about being a half wave off from the ground, are you referring to ground from the earth, or are you actually referring from, if it's on a roof, it has to be a half wave above the roof? Where's your reference point? If you had a dipole strung up on a roof, does it have to be a half wave above the actual roof, even if the roof is not metal?
Yeah, darn good question, and I wish there was a nice, simple answer. That really depends on what is the terrain in front of the antenna. If I had a 1 acre metallic roof on a building, and I'm mounting a horizontal dipole in the middle of it, my takeoff angle on that antenna would be how many wavelengths the antenna is above that metal roof, whether the metal roof is on the ground or it's on the 60th story of a building. If I now have a completely transparent, at 20 meters, wooden house, the real reflecting surface is the ground that's under the house. And now the altitude of the dipole is it the half wavelength above earth in that particular case, if the house is transparent. Now let me drop. When it comes to your particular apartment building in Queens, Howie, how extensive is that apartment building? I guess what we've got to do now is picture ourselves as that radio wave and make believe that we are far out away from the antenna. We're a mile away from the antenna, looking back at the antenna. And if I got a good set of binoculars, I'm going to see the real antenna, and if my eyes worked at 20 meters, I'm going to see the reflection of the antenna in the ground. I'm going to see the real antenna above the ground. I'm going to see the mirror image below the ground. If I've got nothing but an apartment building that is, one wavelength square in north-south direction and east-west direction, and I've got a dipole above it, looks to me like that dipole cares about what is the earth like around that building. When I stand off a mile away, I'm going to see the real one above the ground. I'm going to see the mirror image below the ground, and it's suspended by an apartment building, which almost doesn't count. So I guess it depends on how extensive is your apartment building. For most reasonable construction of buildings that you and I are likely to live in, I think altitude above Earth counts the most. That's my guess on this one, Howie. I'll back to you for a quick comment on that one, Howie.
Okay, that's the reason why I'm asking. By the way, there's been a lot of experiments done by KQ2H and a bunch of guys on 10 meters with repeaters, and they're finding out that horizontal dipoles on a tower, let's say a 10-meter dipole at 100 foot, 100 foot up on a tower, is actually outperforming verticals for DX or E-skip up to 1,000, 1,200 miles. They're finding out they got less noise and they got better signal coverage. That's what they're finding out on receive, that a dipole antenna, horizontal dipoles, on a let's say on a 100-foot tower, 100 feet above the ground, is working better than a vertical for DX stick. Not for ground wave, not for local communication, but they're finding out that the dipoles do outperform the verticals for FM work.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I'm pretty sure what Mel is discovering is that if you have the altitude to measure it, tall enough trees or a tall enough tower, it is extremely difficult to outperform a simple horizontal dipole in bang for the dollar, bang per wind load, whatever, if you've got the altitude. But the problem that Jerry Civic wanted to solve is that you've got a small piece of property, you don't have any tall trees, you don't have a tower. Now how do you get the biggest bang for the dollar? My understanding is that Mel's telling us is that that is the problem that Civic wanted to solve, and we're going to hear more of the details of how he solved it. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just, you know, listening to a lot of news, very, very interesting article on the verticals, by the way, in QST. But this one antenna that always seems to stand out as far as verticals go, that's, I mean, if there's one king of the group, it's that high-gain high tower, that AV-18HT. And it's very, very interesting. If you, I don't know, Dick, if you've ever looked at it or any, but, I mean, this thing covers, like, 10 through 160 meters with, like, two add-on kits. And every time I've heard people, these things are remarkable, and people have even made, you know, four squares with these things. And they're really incredible. I'm just wondering if anybody has ever tried to recreate it with, like, their own homebrew versions of it, or does anybody really understand exactly how that antenna works? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The guys who would know about that are the guys at the Kings County Radio Club. So, Mel, I know we're getting you off subject, but on a quick break, and you're going to take it now, Mel, but one of your comments is how much familiarity do you have with that particular AVHT that Glenn is talking about, that some people think is the best thing since baked bread. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, the high-gain high tower, that is an expensive hunk of iron. Here we go again. We're getting away from the subject, trying to describe how to get into this subject and stay with it, but that is an expensive piece of hardware. I've seen one. It takes up, it's not a small, as they say, you know, small footprint, Dick. This thing is a big piece of metal. It is a type of power, and it has a big price tag on it, so let's let that go for the time being, over.
Agreed. Yeah, the audience you're addressing right now, the 50 emails you're getting per week from guys who are just starting out, they don't have deep pockets, they don't have a great big chunk of land, and they don't have a tall tower in the backyard, and they want to know how to get the biggest bang for the dollar. That's what Jerry Civic was trying to address, and that's what I think you're trying to tell us now, how to get the most for your money. Go ahead, Mel.
KC2QIQ with just one more comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I really wasn't trying to go off course on this one. What I was really trying to bring up the point was that, yes, it is. It's a $1,000 antenna. But I was wondering, has anybody really started studying this thing and figured out a nice cheap way to make one homebrew? Maybe taking some old tower parts and some other elements attached to it and basically try to make a home brew version of it and not have to deal with, like you're saying, it may not be, you know, $1,000 worth of parts. It actually might be something a whole heck of a lot less if you kind of, like, re-engineer it, if you know what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Well, Mel, you've seen one up close. You've laid your hands on it. And therefore, although you didn't probably take it completely apart, do you have a gut feel as to how difficult it would be to build a homebrew version of that? Again, I know we've got you off subject. K2KEY, K2RIW.
There have been some attempts. In fact, one of the attempts that most likely you are heard of and most likely familiar with is a shunt feeding a tower. You can take your tower stick and put a gamma type of matching, and known as shunt feed, and shunt feed the tower. And basically, that's somewhat what they're doing. I won't get into how the high tower really works. I've seen it. I think I know basically the crux of it, but this is basically what you can look at if you wanted to duplicate somewhat a similar experiment, is shunt feeding a tower. But again, this is a lot of hardware, Dick, over.
Okay, I'm going to go to their website and take a quick look at it. But, why don't you continue describing what Jerry Civic did? And from, I get the impression from the favorable response Jerry got to hold with his series of articles, which again gave him the enthusiasm to go build a set of video cassette tapes describing his balance and his electronically small antennas. You might want to describe how successful it all was, how well accepted it was, and in your opinion, for a person who doesn't have a lot of resources of dollars and real estate, is Jerry's approach one of the best ones worth considering? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick, can I just mention a website?
Go right ahead.
Take a look at the DX Engineering version of that. It's actually better than High Gains. It has a little bit more technical information on it as well. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, go to DX Engineering, and then what do I Google after that?
Google High Gain High Tower. So it's just, you know, regular High Gain and HYTOWER. And then when you look at what the Google search pops down, just look at the DX Engineering one and click on that one.
Okay. I'll start doing that while Mel is giving us his recommendation for these guys. You got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yep. It's, like I say, it's a nice hunk of hardware, but it's $1,000 worth of hardware, and not everybody's going to be able to stand it. It's got to stand in your yard one way or the other. It's not something you're going to put up on your roof and simply. So, like I say, we're going to stay with this thing that people have asked me. How can I duplicate one of these verticals that we were talking about for a week now, which have nothing whatsoever to do with any of these more sophisticated verticals, that before you plunk down your money, like I say, for a high tower, $1,000, if you have a place for it, I'd like to try this experiment. I give you the answer to this experiment. This is basically what I would like to do, Dick. Over.
Go right ahead with your description, Mel. And left-handedly, I think you're giving a recommendation, or at least one of the methods that our beginners should be considering as to what some of their early antennas should be like if they don't have the ability to put the half-wave dipole about a half-wave length above the ground. You got it, Mel.
Not only that, this gives you a good insight into what a vertical will do. The outlay is minimum, and this is what basically what Jerry did. He was doing things with what he had on hand, and like he says, bare bones. So here we go. Let's stay with it for a couple of minutes, and people are interested in hearing, and I just got to continue, because otherwise they're going to get lost with other things injected into it. So please, folks, let's just stay with this for couple of minutes, and then we can take questions. He took this 18-foot. We got this 18-foot of pipe, the 10-foot of mass, the vertical 8-foot on top of it gives us 18 feet. He went up on a roof. He put a bent a piece of plate, a piece of aluminum plate over the V of the roof, and on top of it he put some kind of a piece of material for an insulator to insulate his pipe. He tied it off with four pieces of string, And now this man laid down some random radios, whatever he had in number 22 wire, spread it out as best as he could. He thinks he had at least 20 pieces down. Okay, so now he has his coax, his RG-8U coax coming up there. And now he's got to match this thing. He's got